Everybody's bonus time. More bonuses. Bonuses on bonuses on bonuses. We're going to talk again. We're going to touch the bottom of the pool, friends. Deep dive into Eyes Wide Shut. If you're caught up, you heard the first two shows in this series where we went through the whole film, all the conspiracies and the symbolism within it. Then, because you're so great, with all your great support on whichever platform you choose, I like all of them. It's up to you, your flavor of support, Rockfin, Patreon, or the VIP section. Because you're so great, I gave you a deep dive into the novella from which the Kubrick film was adapted. So by now, you've got an opinion on this movie. Basically, Kubrick was showing us the sacrificial ritual elites, how they control all of society. Sex and death are part of this, part of the occult rituals that these elites are playing with. And now, we're going to do another bonus show, only for the supporters. You're not on that loser free feed anymore. You're with the winners. The winner. I love everybody. I joke, you know. Now some of you have to cut out sometimes because you got bills or whatever and you can't support for a few months, and that's cool. Much love to you. I'll see you someday if you come back. As I always say, I want you to take care of you and yours first. If that means you can't cut your boy Isaac a slice of cheddar that month because you got to get the old lady some flowers because you done screwed up, do it. Do it. I want you happy more than anything. But we're going to go deeper for another bonus supporter show. This one, we're talking about a book that, if you want to take it to level 10, level 11, Eyes Wide Shut knowledge, you got to read this book, Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick and the Making of His Final Film by Robert Coker and Nathan Abrams. Should I interview him? Yes. Will I? I don't know. I will try to. I've been busy. It's been a crazy few months. I'm trying to write this damn book, this alien book, Use Your Illusion 2. I want to get it out before this Department of Defense knowledge drop. And I keep getting distracted. I got obsessive about Eyes Wide Shut and I deep dived, and that's what we're all about right now. We're about that Eyes Wide Shut action. So I'm going to give you, this is probably going to be two episodes. Yeah, it's going to be two episodes. And a lot of it is going to be me reading to you from this book. Because look, I know some of you don't want to read these big ass books. This is a big ass book too, by the way. But I'm going to give you my cliff notes pulled directly from the book. I actually read it on Kindle, which made it very easy to export the notes. And then I'll give my worthless, stupid 2 cents along the way. Okay? All right. Let's go. Without further ado, let's just get into it. At the beginning of the book, they're talking about sort of the background of Kubrick, because, you know, he did many films before Eyes Wide Shut. I'm going to read you. Here we go. Kirk Douglas claims his psychiatrist introduced Kubrick to Tromnovel. That's the name of the book, right? Dream Novella. Like I told you in the last show, there's a few names for this same book. Tromnovel is one of them. Dream Novella. Okay, back to the thing. Kirk Douglas basically said that his psychiatrist introduced Kubrick to Tromnovel while working on Spartacus. In May, Kubrick invites Schnitzler's grandson, Peter, to the set of Spartacus. 1968, Kubrick allegedly reads Tromnovel for the first time. May 22nd, Kubrick asks Jay Cox to secure the rights to the novella. In 1970, Kubrick begins to concentrate on adapting Tromnovel. In April, Kubrick asks Jan Harlan to secure the rights, which he does. Harlan makes a rough translation of Schnitzler's German text. Kubrick buys up every existing copy of the published novel. So he's talking about Arthur Schnitzler, the guy who wrote Dream Novella, right? I'm assuming you're caught up with the shows. And yeah, Kubrick bought up every single published copy. The ones that the German Nazis hadn't burned up. Remember? Hitler called it Jewish filth. Then in 1973, Jan Harlan arranges for a one-year extension of his option to acquire the motion picture rights to the novella at a cost of 5,000 DM, approximately $1,500. Kubrick considers filming Traum Novelle in black and white as a low-budget art house film set in Dublin with Woody Allen playing a middle-aged Jewish doctor. Now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about Woody Allen. That's right. Woody Allen. The guy who's, I don't know if you're watching the HBO shows on him. I haven't yet. I got to. It's on my list. Guy who married, what, he married his own daughter or something crazy, right? It's actually worse than that. I'm going to read you from, this is from Wikipedia. In 1979, Woody Allen began a professional and personal relationship with actress Mia Farrow. You know who she is, right? From Rosemary's Baby? Yes, yes, indeed. And over a decade-long period, collaborated in 13 films. They separated, and in 1992, Farrow made the public allegation that he had sexually abused their 7-year-old adopted daughter, Dylan. The allegation gained substantive media attention, but Allen was never charged, prosecuted, and vigorously denied the charge. Now, what's very odd is all these connections here. Mia Farrow, of course, in Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary's Baby, written by, oh, what's his name? Is it Ira Levin? Oh, dear. Hang on a second. Hang on a minute. Well, it was directed by Roman Polanski, right? But that's not who I wanted to... Ira Levin, yes. Dear goodness, that took a while. Okay, so Ira Levin wrote Rosemary's Baby, and he wrote... Is that a male? Is that a male name? Ira? Yes, male. And he wrote The Stepford Wives, which starred Nicole Kidman. But Rosemary's Baby, also directed by Roman Polanski, who, in fact, was convicted of, you know, I don't, what was he convicted of? We'll say allegedly, just to cover myself. Allegedly, you know, what, like raping and drugging a girl, a 13-year-old girl in his hot tub or something like that? What the hell's going on in Hollywood, right? And then they had a child, one of those children, Ronan O'Sullivan Farrow, who's the son of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen. He worked in the New York Times, and he was essentially the guy who kicked off the Me Too movement, right? He was very much interested in exposing a lot of the sexual abuse. Ronan Farrow was the guy who sort of exposed Harvey Weinstein, and it was part of the Me Too movement. Let me clarify that. These are very sensitive subjects we're glossing over because I didn't actually prepare for all that. I just wanted to point out that Woody Allen is one of these directors who allegedly, you know, is messing around with these kids, his own kids sometimes. And how curious that Stanley Kubrick originally wanted Woody Allen to play the role of Bill Harford. And in the book, because we read Dream Novella, remember, Bill Harford reveals he had a fantasy about a 15-year-old girl, which is not in the film. So this, of course, raises a lot of eyebrows, a lot of questions. Was Kubrick exposing these folks, or was he, like, buddies with these folks? He apparently was a big fan of Woody Allen. Anyway, let's keep it moving. Next. It's important to note here, at this moment in the middle of the late 1950s, while Kubrick was making gangster films and would soon make his second war movie, Paths of Glory, he wanted to film another Austrian writer's work, Stefan Zweig's 1913 Burning Secret. Zweig's novella is about a child who unwittingly acts as a go-between for his married mother and her would-be seducer. It's a disturbing story with sexuality and child abuse churning beneath its surface. It had already been made into a German film by Robert Siedmak in 1933 and would be made again by Kubrick's assistant Andrew Birkin in 1988. So look, Kubrick's got a lot of stuff he showed us of child abuse. Of course, we've got all these things we're talking about right now with Eyes Wide Shut. We've got The Shining, if you read my book, Kubrick's Code. that has a very heavy undertone of child abuse in it. You know, all of his films had some element of sexuality in them, but like the child thing, I don't know. He wanted Woody Allen in this one. It's a very, very strange connections going on here. And like some would argue that maybe he was into this stuff. I don't know. I hate to believe that because I love Kubrick's movies. So let's keep reading. Spartacus also taught Kubrick that what he did not want to do again. He was, during the production of this film, an oppressed worker, chafing under a studio producer's control. This was not what the independently minded Kubrick wanted, and he realized that to obtain the control he needed, he would need to leave Hollywood. He would not make another film in the United States. After the premiere of 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1968, he never returned there. Now, that's very curious, right? Some people say that he disliked Hollywood and the weirdos within it, and that's why he left. Some people say that he just loved England so much that he wanted to get away from America, but he never came back. Why? Why during Eyes Wide Shut did he go through such painstaking detail to recreate the sets to make it look like New York City, a place he grew up and loved, yet he never revisited? Well, the counterclaim is that he was terrified to travel. Well, he traveled over to the England. Anyhow, again, make of it what you will. Next. The trials of masculinity as it exists within the domestic sphere are central to Kubrick's work. How men strive and fail, creating the means of their own destruction. Sorry, I'm having a hard time reading today. Not a good day to be reading to you from my notes. Falling under the burden of sexual angst or complex schemes that overwhelm them is crucial to understanding every one of his films. Whether the catastrophes are external to the characters or internal, part of their psyches, as in Eyes Wide Shut, the results are always the same. Some sort of collapse, defeat, occasionally a recognition, sometimes a profound change, though never an epiphany. So again, just talking about masculinity, femininity, sex, how it all plays together. Clearly part of Eyes Wide Shut. Next. Jack Torrance might be considered Bill Harford's id. Jack, the would-be writer, his wife, and young son are holed up in a hotel, haunted by Jack's own twisted unconscious. Like the monsters from the id in the 1956 science fiction film Forbidden Planet, a film that Kubrick admired and that was an influence on 2001, Jack's unconscious manifests itself as ghostly apparitions and violent acts. Now, here's the thing. Let me explain to you what the id is, in case you don't know. The id comes from libido, right? Libido comes from the id, excuse me. It's the instinctual reptilian brain. Then outside of that, you got the ego. That's the mediator between the id and the superego. The superego is your social constructs, that's the norms, that's morality handed down to you from families and cultures and societies and religion. And your ego is the mediator between the reptilian instincts and the social constructs. And different people have different levels of control between the two. And when he says Jack Torrance might be considered Bill Harford's id, meaning what Jack does in the movie, hack his family up, might be something buried within Bill Harford, which, as you recall from my film analysis in Eyes Wide Shut, the whole film, my man Tom Cruise, he's struggling. He's constantly, like, deer in the headlights, like, he wants to bang all these chicks. He wants to bang all of them, and he just can't do it. The ego, the mediator, is stopping him. And just when he's able to overcome the ego, at the end, when he goes to visit Domino the prostitute, and she's not there, but her roommate is, and Bill's like, it's about to go down, baby. It's about to go down. But then she's like, hey, guess what? Domino's got the HIV, And then he's now in fear, and he's like, I don't want to die. And then, again, social constructs and fears take over. Here's a fun joke. It's inappropriate, so my apologies to the people easily offended. Like I said earlier, Kubrick wanted to film this Eyes Wide Shut set in Dublin. And the joke I heard once, and I don't remember too many jokes, and it's so inappropriate. Should I even say it? No, I think I won't. All right, fine, I will. The joke is, you must be Irish, because when I see you, my penis be Dublin. There we go. Inappropriate, yes, but appropriate for the film, right? Appropriate for the film, because it's all about male sexuality. It's all about the id, the instincts, the animalistic desires, and Bill Harford's struggle to tame those. And not only to tame those, to let them loose when he's ready to let them loose. Because he didn't like that Alice was ready to bust loose that id. Alice was going to have sexy time with the naval officer, with L. Ron Hubbard, remember? She told Bill, she's like, look, I was going to do it. I would have done it. I would have thrown this all away. And that's what the movie is all about, essentially. And that's what this book says. It talks about the trials of masculinity. And Jack Torrance, Bill Harford's id. Because you know what? Sometimes you want to axe murder your family. You know what? You've had it. Always crying about this and that. Just leave me alone. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, that's what it's about. Okay, next. Jeez. It was translated into English by Otto P. Schneider as Rhapsody, a dream novel in 1927 and reissued in 1955. This was the edition, along with a translation made by his executive producer and brother-in-law, Jan Harlan, that Kubrick eventually used to develop his film. Then they talk a little bit about Zionism, and they say he was a friend of Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism. I got my note here because I wanted to clarify. Arthur Schnitzler, the author of Dream Novella, was friends with the guy that invented Zionism, Theodor Herzl. Did you know someone invented Zionism? I didn't know that. You know, it's like and Zionism always comes up in the conspiracy movement, right? And I'm far from an expert on it, but I do know that the conspiracy people always say everything's like a Zionist plot. And they say, well, it's not against the Jewish people, because here's the problem. Historically, conspiracy theories have always existed to persecute the Jews. And it's one of these landmines that I just don't want to step in. And you've got to know a lot about this, and I'm just going to read you from Wikipedia, because I'm not an expert here. This is what Zionism is. It's an ideology and a nationalist movement among the Jewish people that espouses the reestablishment of and support of a Jewish state centered in the area roughly corresponding to Canaan, the Holy Land, or the region of Palestine. But apparently the guy who started that movement was buddies with Arthur Schnitzler. How does that fit into the storyline? Well, in the storyline in the Dream Novella, there's like some Jewish elements in there. And then Kubrick, of course, he put the Kanishas in the movie. You remember we talked about that. Then the book talks about Schnitzler a bunch. It says Schnitzler was prodigious sexually with many mistresses and affairs, and literarily an introspective author who used his work as a process of self-analysis. He was a dueling, philandering, cosmopolitan polymath who kept a diary of his promiscuous sex life, including, it is said, every orgasm he had had. He has been described as perhaps the most famous portrayer of adultery in literature written in German. Schnitzler was obsessed with sex in his life as well as his writing. Schnitzler's treatment of sex and sexuality appealed to Kubrick. His written works are mostly about sexual affairs, liaisons, adultery, betrayals, seduction. In his 1902 short story, Death of a Bachelor, for example, the letter of a dead man reveals to his friends that he had seduced each one of their wives. At one point, Kubrick wanted to film it. The blasting of domestic tranquility seems to have been as much on Schnitzler's mind as the sexual act itself, which in Schnitzler was always suggested, even though, given the time in which he wrote, never described. And that is, my friend, why the book did not have a Gnostic orgy in it. Remember that? Remember how we made a big deal about that? We made a big stink. I said, this was such a big part of the Kubrick movie, it's not even in the book. But that apparently was a big thing in Schnitzler's mind, the penetration of the social construct and marriage and fidelity. It was a theme in all of his books. And that short story, Death of a Bachelor, sure does sound interesting. The letter of a dead man reveals to his friends he seduced each one of their wives. How you like them apples? Ouch. Let's keep reading. But there are also its themes of dreams. This is the dream novella. The fluid boundaries between dream and reality. The doubling of characters and events. There's that Dublin joke. The penis is Dublin joke. Huh? Get it? The doubling of characters and events. The crisis of the male libido. Identity. Odysseys. Fantasies. Marriage. Dysfunctional family dynamics and sexuality that show up frequently in Kubrick's work. From his earliest photographs and documentaries through his final film. This intertwining of interest helps seal the bond between the two artists, with sexuality being a most important link. Sex was often on Kubrick's mind. Tony Fruin, Kubrick's longtime assistant, recalls that Kubrick was fascinated by pornography and the erotic, and sexual imagery permeates Kubrick's work from his earliest photography for Look magazine through his last film. This is interesting. Full Metal Jacket can be read as a long reverie on sexual repression. The film climaxes with the killing of a female sniper whose dying plea of shoot me, coupled with Rafterman's observations of hardcore, plays on the double meaning of firing a gun and making a pornographic movie. Wow. And I don't know if you've seen Full Metal Jacket. Plot spoiler. But like, I'll tell you what happens. This is based off of memory. I've seen it many, many times. Basically, at the end, Rafterman and the Marines, they're in Vietnam. There's a sniper. They get up to the sniper's location. They wound her. And she's suffering because she's still alive, right? And she's laying on the ground. They're all kind of huddled around her. And she's like, shoot me, shoot me. Because she wants to be taken out of her misery, right? And Joker is like, we need to kill her. We got to put her out of her misery. And then someone else on the crew was like, well, then you do it. And he pulls out his 9 and pow. And then... Was it Rafterman? It must be Rafterman. That's what it says in the book here. Rafterman's like, hardcore, man. Fucking hardcore. I think that's the quote. But anyhow, the point being, there's double entendres in a lot of Kubrick's work because the dude was obsessed with sex, apparently, right? So when I concluded Eyes Wide Shut and said it's about sex and death, you see why I said that now, right? Like Schnitzler, the tension between interiority and the external world percolated up from a Freudian base where sexuality and its discontents drive their characters' misadventures. Always Sigmund Freud. Kubrick was drawn to Schnitzler and even more fervently to Freud. Kubrick mentioned how Schnitzler's plays are absolute gems of buried psychological motivation. Freud was drawn to Schnitzler and once wrote to him, quote, I have gained the impression that you have learned through intuition, though actually as a result of sensitive introspection, everything that I had to unearth by laborious work on other persons. Freud's letter is worth quoting in full. I think I avoided you out of a kind of fear of encountering my double. So again, we always talk about Freud and Edward Bernays and Carl Jung and all those folks. They were kind of thought leaders of how the mind works, how the ego works, the true nature of man, all that stuff. Now listen to this. It talks about how Stanley Kubrick met his wife, Christiane. The circumstances of their face-to-face meeting uncannily echo Fridolin's in Tromnovel. They met in person, Christiane recalls, at an enormous masked ball where I was performing. He was the only one without a costume. He was quite baffled. Kubrick's marriage to Christiane might have very briefly diverted his thoughts from stories of marital infidelity. Next, that was just interesting. While working on Dr. Strangelove, Kubrick and Terry Southern, who had collaborated on the movie, discussed the possibility of a major Hollywood director making a big budget, hardcore pornographic film with high production values. Although this never materialized, the ideas ended up in Southern's 1970 novel Blue Movie, which Kubrick pushed him to write, and which was dedicated to the great Stanley Kay. He also informed a French magazine that he planned to adapt Tromnovel as a big-budget, big-cast porn film. Yes, it was going to be a porno. Kubrick was going to direct a massive porno. Isn't that something? Crazy. Let's see, what else we got here? His second daughter, Anya, called Eyes Wide Shut a very personal statement from my father. He felt very strongly about the subject and theme, and he honed down in it exactly the ideas, principles, and moral philosophies he had lived by. This is the closest statement we have about the deeply personal relationship felt between Kubrick and the film he would make of Tromnovel. What started many years ago as an intellectual attachment became Kubrick's most personal, possibly autobiographical film. Autobiographical. Talking about the struggles of marriage, but more curiously, about a secret society of elites coordinating a ritual of blood sacrifice at a sex orgy, a Gnostic sex orgy. Isn't that crazy? According to Christiane, Stanley worked on the script of Tromnovel on and off between other projects for many years. At this point, Kubrick was considering filming Tromnovel in black and white as a low-budget arthouse film, perhaps in the manner of Lolita. The film would take place in Dublin, influenced by James Joyce's Ulysses and his short story The Dead, or Mock New York, using surrogate locations in Ireland and London, with Woody Allen in the lead, playing a middle-aged Jewish doctor. It was always New York and present time, Harlan recalls. But Kubrick never spoke to Woody Allen, says Harlan. I met Woody in New York and told him all this, and he said that Stanley had never asked him. But I know that Stanley had had him in mind, and he was pretty sure that Woody would play the part, had this become a project. It's a great part, and the two would have harmonized splendidly. Stanley loved Woody Allen's films, particularly the early funny ones. So again, Woody Allen, this very controversial guy, was supposed to play the role of Bill, Dr. Bill. This one's interesting. Maybe other factors were pressing on him. Kubrick's life was beginning to wear down. There were domestic problems. His daughter, Vivian, left for America in 1994, eventually joining Scientology and beginning the process of disconnection from her family that the church demanded of its adherents, events that were a blow to Kubrick's lasting affection for his family. You're a smart person. You already know where we're going with that one. Just what? 2 years prior to starting the filming? With stars Tom Cruise? The most famous Scientologist on the planet? He was upset because his daughter left and joined Scientology? You don't think this is a coincidence? You don't think that L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, the naval officer, banging Alice, is a coincidence? We already talked about how in the book, it's not a naval officer, it's just a Denmark military officer. It's all connected here. He knew what he was doing. He knew who he chose for these roles. Let's see what else we got here. He seemed not very interested in words. He might admire the sharpness of my dialogue, but it was not something he wanted to film. And film alone was his art form. Kubrick wanted to show, not tell. So again, this idea that he's showing us something of great importance without overtly saying it out loud, leaving weirdos like me and you to look through his films and say, what was he trying to say? Everything means something. They talk about the different drafts of the script. Blah, blah, blah. He requested a redraft. Raphael did some research, reading about a notorious sex party at the Vatican on October 31, 1501, attended by Pope Alexander VI. He consulted Richard Sennett's Flesh and Stone and Georgia Mason's Courtesans of the Italian Renaissance. This time, Raphael returns to Schnitzler and drafts a more ecclesiastical air inside a side chapel at nighttime. So here's where we learn about the origins of this sex party, the Gnostic sex party. It was written into the script, right? Because the book didn't have it. Dream Novella didn't talk about it. And it was at the Vatican where the Pope attended on October 31. Samhain. A pagan, Halloween satanic night. There's three satanic holidays. There's your birthday, there's Samhain, Halloween. I think Beltane's the other one. So you can see that there was some thought that went into this, but like, does that blow your mind that the Pope was at a sex party? Crazy stuff. Maybe that was the point. Maybe the point was to blow your mind. Let's keep going. They're explaining the whole thing, right? This might be the biggest. I might conclude part one of this analysis right here with this one, because you're not going to believe what I'm about to read you. Man, aren't you happy you're not on the free feed with the losers? They don't know. They're still in the dark, uninitiated. No clue what's going on with anything. No, I'm just kidding. This is actually like, when I read this book, my jaw was dropped the whole time. And it's a big-ass book, and it's got flowery language, so it wasn't easy to read. But, oh my goodness, wait till you hear this. They're explaining how they wanted the scene to look with the Gnostic orgy. A naked woman lies on an altar. There is a side table with rows of silver knives and forks and spoons, as if for a formal buffet. A man is dressed in a cardinal's beretta. He flourishes a knife. The naked woman turns out to be a sculpture of ice cream. The assembled priests and noblemen spoon or cut their favorite meat from her body. Yes, yes, yes. Yes. Spirit cooking. Kubrick was talking about the spirit cooking. You know the spirit cooking. Do we have to go back there? Maybe we do. I don't know where you're at on your journey of enlightenment to the occult ways. Marina Abramovich had these spirit cooking parties where they mocked the cannibalism of a person. And that's where all these, all the liberals and Hollywood elites were attending these parties. And that's what gets you into Pizzagate and all this crazy stuff. And then child abuse comes with it. Kubrick almost showed you spirit cooking in Eyes Wide Shut. Is that not enough to blow your mind? My goodness. All right. Well, I've got even more, if you can believe that. I got a busy schedule today, so I'm going to come back and I'm going to finish part two with you very soon. We're going to go through a lot more. If you thought your mind was blown with part one here, wait till you get to part two. Again, another bonus thing, only for my supporters. You know I love you. I love you guys for your support. I appreciate you no matter where you're at. If you're on the Patreon, if you're on the VIP section, if you're on the Rockfin, shout out. I love you guys for your support. You're the best. And I'm giving you my best right here. This is crazy stuff we're learning about Eyes Wide Shut and Kubrick. When I wrote Kubrick's Code, I thought I knew it all. But boy, was I ignorant. Now I know it all. Now you know it all. And we know it all. And there's actually more to come. I'm going to come back with part two, reading from this book. So until then, my friend, you know what to do. Stay woke.